I've known for a good while. Met him years ago at the old church I went to. We made a real strong connection. I put his phone in my iPhone, and then never called him. And then like 7 years later, he was here, and I'm like, Nate Gernish, that name sounds familiar. And sure enough, yeah, it was mutual. Yeah, he never called me either. It's two ways, you know. It's a two-way relationship. So, but then I met him for a second time. I'm like, that sounds familiar, and I'm like, oh yeah, I have your phone number. It was weird, but he'll be speaking first, and then we'll have Brandon come up. But I'll go ahead and start this. You ready? All right.
Shabbat. Pray this in Yeshua's name. Amen. Well, this morning we're looking at this portion, Vayeshev, Jacob sat or Jacob dwelled. Brandon and I were doing this together, and so we didn't know kind of how we wanted to divide things up or how we wanted to look at it. And I hadn't really looked much at the portion, and I asked Brandon, well, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I'd like to take the last half and you take the first half. And I thought, okay, that sounds reasonable. And then I started to look at it and I realized that actually Brandon knew, like, well, if Nate takes the first half, that's really kind of reflective of Nate, and the last half's kind of more reflective of me. So let me talk about here real quickly an outline of what we're looking at today. We start off here in chapter 37. The first few verses, Jacob is settling in Hebron. He establishes Joseph as his favorite son. Joseph has these dreams. And then we get to the part that's kind of like me. There's these brothers. They make bad decisions. They sell their brother into slavery. And then we get to the next part, Judah and Tamar. Judah goes down to Adullam, and he gets into this affair with Tamar, makes some bad decisions there. And so I thought, okay, he's given me the bad decision part. Then we get to the good decision part, right? So here's this fellow Joseph, like Brandon, he makes good decisions. Joseph in Potiphar's house, he flees temptation, and he does the right thing. And then I thought, really, this is probably sealing the deal. Joseph ends up in prison, and here's Brandon, his parents have just moved home. He probably feels like he's in prison as well. So there you go. I figured out where Brandon was going with this. So, but anyway, that's a quick overview of what we're looking at in our portion this week. So I'm going to look at chapters 37, and hopefully we'll have some time to look at 38 as well. But we kind of dig in here at the beginning of 37 with Jacob, and it says, Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. And these are the chronicles of Jacob. A lot of different versions here say Jacob settled, Jacob lived, Jacob dwelt. Versus he settled, he lived, he dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings, or in the land that his father was a stranger in, or the land that his father lived in as a foreigner. I thought it was really interesting. If you go and you look at maps of the patriarchs and the travels of the patriarchs, you see this map of Abraham, and here's Abraham. He starts over here in Ur, and he comes across, and he comes down into Canaan, and he goes into Egypt, and he comes back into Canaan, and it's this great big map. And then you get to the map of the travels of Isaac, and it's about this big. He just kind of travels locally. He doesn't move a whole lot from Canaan. And then we go to Jacob, and of course, we know the story of Jacob. We've been talking about it. Jacob, he starts in the household of Isaac, but then he flees there. He goes to Bethel. He goes up to his uncle Laban. He lives with his uncle Laban. He comes back down. As he's coming home, he meets Esau, his brother, and instead of going back down into Hebron, he goes up to Shechem, and then eventually comes back down into Hebron. So here's Jacob over his life. He has traveled a great distance as well. And it's interesting that this section starts with Jacob dwelling or living or deciding, I'm done traveling. I'm done with all of these experiences, and now I'm gonna establish myself in this place. That it seems to indicate was a foreign place or a place of sojourning for his father, who really didn't travel that far, is this place that Jacob is identifying as his home. I think that that's very interesting when we go through the end of the book of Genesis and we realize that Jacob doesn't stay there. He moves down to Egypt, that Adonai has different plans for Jacob's life than Jacob had for his life, that although he thought that he would settle, and maybe that there was a sense of, hey, I've accomplished a lot, and I'm ready to just kind of sit back and relax, that there was actually something else that was going on here. So anyway, we go on, and it says that Joseph, at the age of 17, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph would bring evil reports about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, since he was the child of his old age, and he made him a fine woolen tunic. We had a discussion about this last night around the table. I have five children, four boys, one girl, and so I don't have quite as many boys as Jacob did. But I asked we were talking about this, and I said to the kids, you know, the question came up, is it okay that Jacob was playing favorites? And my older two, the two that are above five, were both like, oh no. No, it's not okay that Jacob's playing favorites. The three that were below, I'm not sure they quite understood what was going on. I think they were okay with whatever Daddy said. So they didn't have an opinion. But we really kind of got into this discussion of this idea of, well, is it okay that he plays favorites? Is it okay that the other 10 brothers know that, these older 10 brothers know that Joseph, the young one, is the favorite in the household? I don't know. I can't tell you if I play favorites because my son's here, so it wouldn't be fair for me to reveal any family secrets. But I don't know. But I want to return to that idea here in a few minutes as we continue to discuss this. But it says that this favoritism that Jacob is playing with Joseph is causing a lot of tension in the family. We look at the end of verse 4, it says, they could not speak peaceably to him, which I think is significant, that not only do they not get along with Joseph, or do they find that it's annoying that he is the favorite, they actually can't talk peaceably to him. I'm sure that probably I'm the only one here who's had this experience where you know somebody that you just kind of avoid because you know you can't really come up with peaceable things to talk about with them. Like, maybe you can say hello, but after that, you're just like, probably not good words are going to come out of my mouth, right? This is the experience these guys are having as brothers. And then we heighten that experience by Joseph adding in now these dreams. He has these dreams in which he indicates, hey, by the way, I'm going to be elevated. I am going to be the star of the show here, and you guys are going to bow down to me. And we see evidence here that the brothers indicate to him, are you going to be king over us? Are you going to rule over us? These two terms used, number one, to be king, like, are you going to have a position of authority over us? But that second, are you going to rule over us, more implying that you would be more of a tyrant. Like, we actually don't want you to rule over us. This is not a voluntary thing. Like, as a king, we would voluntarily say, like, okay, you're the king, you're the leader. But this second, will you rule over us, is more of a, well, you might think that you're ruling, but we're not actually giving allegiance to you. We don't agree with this. We don't agree with this statement. And then to go on to have another dream in which he says, not only will you brothers bow down to me, but also the sun and the moon, maybe mom and dad or these other people. And so his father, right, he gives him this kind of, he chides him a little bit like, oh, come on, be serious. Like, your mother's not even around. How can this dream be true? But yet Jacob files this away in his mind and says, you know, I need to remember, I need to think about what's going on here. But these things kind of heighten, they add to this disunity that now the brothers are jealous of him. And I don't know if the jealousness is a turning of emotions where the brothers, you know, they begin with this idea of like, we just can't be at peace with him. And now they're like, boy, there's just something that that really burns within us that is making us, you know, jealous of maybe the relationship that he has with the father, or maybe it's this spiritual sense that he has, because remember, dreams are seen as kind of a spiritual, a look into the spiritual window. But perhaps they're feeling threatened at this point by Joseph, not just annoyed, and they think that maybe they should do something here. So the brothers, they leave. They actually take off with the herds, and they head to Shechem, which is interesting, odd, maybe bizarre, that this place where there's been such devastation for their family, especially with their sister Dinah, and then them to come back and slay all these men and kill them, they're like, oh, hey, let's go back to Shechem. This sounds wonderful. You know, Shechem is a crossroads town at the time, so there's lots of traffic through there. There's lots of things going on there. Probably a kind of cool place to hang out if that's what you're into. And so maybe that was a pool, but they go on and move on to Shechem. And then I think the most bizarre event of this whole thing happens next. Sometimes, I don't know, it could be just be me as a dad, but like sometimes I think dads, we don't always catch like the full sense of what's happening within our family. And I'm wondering if this is what happened like with Jacob here, but I think we're going to see maybe not. But, you know, I can come home from work and all the kids say hi to me and it's great. And then I'll be standing in the kitchen talking to Rachel, my wife, and we're going on and on. And like, there's this background noise, you know, of children doing their thing. And I'm talking to her, and all of a sudden she'll be like, you need to do something. And I'm like, what do you mean I need to do something? And she's like, you need to go do something. Okay. And so off I go to the kids, and I mean, like, no sooner do I get there than, like, fists are flying, and people are going crazy at each other, and crying, and, like, mayhem is broken loose. And I'm like, how does she know this? Like, I don't understand how she knows that it's about to happen, but she does, okay? So maybe Jacob, like, he can't see the writing on the wall here. You know, like, okay, here's my favorite son. I treat him way different than the rest of them. They don't like him. They don't want to talk to him. He's had these dreams. They're jealous of him. And now the brothers have gone off, and he says to his son, Israel said to Joseph, your brothers are pasturing in Shechem, are they not? Come, I will send them. I will send you to them. And Joseph said to him, here I am. And he said to him, go now, look into the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring me back word. So he sent him from the depth of Hebron, and he arrived in Shechem. I wonder if it's the same word that he's going to bring, that he had brought back earlier in the chapter when it says that Joseph brings back evil reports. Right? I mean, it's just bizarre to me, like, hey, it's my favorite son. He's going to bring back evil reports. His brothers hate him. His brothers are away in Shechem. Like, hey, why don't you go check on your brothers? Everything will be okay. In fact, it reminds me of Matthew 21 we are all familiar with the parable of the landowner, right? The landowner, he cultivates this vineyard and he puts this moat around it. And he does all this work and then he rents it out to these tenants and he leaves. And it comes time for the rent to be due and he sends his servants back. And the tenants beat up the servants. And so he sends some more servants and they beat up the other servants. And finally the landowner is like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll send my son. Because somehow that's going to change what they do. Like they've beaten up all these servants, but they'll respect. They won't beat up my son. And in verse 37, it says, finally, he sent them his son saying, my son, they will respect. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, this is his heir. Come, let us kill him and take his inheritance. I feel like it's the same thing happening here. And of course, we know that Joseph is a picture of Yeshua, and in this parable, we're also talking about Yeshua here. But there's this similarity. The son is being sent. The father, in his eyes, he can see the full beauty, the full importance, the full manifestation of who his son is, and he expects that these others are going to respect, are going to see that, are going to feel the same way. So I think we could kind of keep going at this point and talk about what we kind of clearly know, which is the providence of Adonai through this story. But I also want to kind of branch out here and look at two separate stories, I think, that are happening at this same time. First is the story that we know, that we've learned in our faith. But I think the other is a story that, at least for me, is a story that I know in my heart. So the story that we learned, right? Here's our brothers. They're mad at Joseph. He's the favorite. He goes to look for them. They throw him in a pit. He's sold into slavery. Jacob is grieved, but Adonai prevails. Right? We see it from the start in this whole thing. Right? Let's back up again. I said, remember Jacob playing favorites with Joseph. Notice when this portion starts, what name is used for Jacob? Jacob, right? But when it turns in verse 3, who is it that loves Joseph? It's Israel. It's Israel that loves Joseph more than any of the others. And again, when we get to verse 13, who is it that sends Joseph off to see his brothers? It's Israel. Yeah. And if we remember last week, we talked about how that twice Jacob had his name changed from Jacob to Israel. And then throughout the remainder of his life in Genesis, we see him referred to, I believe it was it Jacob 44 times and Israel 88 or 40 and 80, or I would have written that down. I would have remembered it, but I didn't. So we're 40. There we go. Israel 40 and Jacob 80. Okay, and so there was this differentiation between when Jacob is making a, I'm going to call it like a carnal Jacob, like everyday decision, and when the Lord is speaking of his higher nature, his spiritual nature, and he refers to him as Israel, and he says, you know, Israel. So I think there's an indication right from the very beginning of this story that there is something different about Joseph. Right as we meet Joseph at 17 here, it's not Jacob. It's not the man who is playing favorites with him, but it is this higher spiritual being. There's a sense here that there's something different about Jacob. Now, I'm not saying that Jacob maybe did a bad job at playing favorites. Right? Like maybe he could have done a little better job with the other 10 boys and they wouldn't have felt so alienated by him. But we'll stay to the text, and the text says this is what he did. But he definitely sensed something special about Joseph, and he's doing something with that. And it's also this higher nature, this higher spiritual nature of Israel, who is sending Joseph out. Maybe he knows in his heart something's going to happen to him. Maybe he doesn't. But that's who's sending him out. So I think we see clearly right from the beginning what we know to be true, which is Adonai is moving throughout this story to orchestrate events, to save the world through this famine, to bring the people into Egypt so that later he can call them out and continue to work his plan. But I think we also see that there is something else that's going on in this story. And that's, just for me, the story of my own heart here. Right? You've also got these 10 regular, everyday guys who are trying to, like, sort their way through life. You know, figure out what it means to be one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Figure out what it means to live their life, figure out what it means to be brothers, all of these things. And they've got these herds of sheep, and they've got to get the sheep fed. And they're having family problems at home. And so it's probably kind of relaxing to be like, I'm going to take off and run up to Shechem with the sheep and the goats and hang out there. And you've got this place, Shechem, which is an interesting place to go, but, you know, here they are at Shechem anyway. Actually, as I was reading that, it reminded me of Proverbs, our study in Proverbs, and Proverbs 7 through 9, when it says, I have seen among the simple, I have perceived among the youth, a young man lacking sense, passing along the street near her corner, taking the road to her house. Those were the words that came to my mind as these 10 men are traveling their way to Shechem. Like, what a foolish decision to leave the presence of your father, to leave the presence of your family, and to go off towards Shechem, a place that you know is evil, that evil things have happened in your past. But there they are. So I imagine them, right, camping that night around the fire, getting ready to go to bed. You know, hey, good night, Reuben. Good night, Dan. Good night, Simeon. Good night, Judah. Judah. We're going to pick on Judah because the rest of the text kind of picks on him. So, you know, Judah. You know, guys, I was really thinking, you know, Joseph, he's really dishonoring our dad. I mean, think about this. He's having a dream where he is implying that he is more important than our dad, that our dad's going to bow down to him, that our dad's going to, you know, like, this isn't okay. We need to defend dad's honor. You know what? I think that dad is so blinded by the favoritism that he's paying to Joseph that he probably can't even see how disrespectful Joseph's being. And I can imagine the rest of the brothers going, no, I think Judah's got a point here. Like, Judah's got this a good, yeah. You know, it's like we already don't like the guy. But we've got like a legitimate reason to not like him now. We've got to defend our dad's honor. Like, this isn't okay. We need to seek a way to take care of this. And it's interesting, right? Joseph goes off. He goes to Shechem to find his brothers. Are his brothers in Shechem? No. His brothers have moved from Shechem to Dothan, right? Which means law or double law. And some of the sages suggest that they were in fact leaving Shechem to go seek legal counsel, legal advice, a legal way to get rid of their brother. Does this sound familiar at all as we think about the story of Yeshua? Right? The religious leaders are upset with Yeshua. Why? Well, he claims to be the Son of God. Like, he can't claim to be equal with God. He can't claim to know God's heart, God's thoughts, that he can be speaking the words of God. He's stirring up the people. We don't like him. Right? So as Joseph comes to see his brothers, his brothers are conspiring. They're figuring out a way. How do we take care of this Joseph problem? And just like the religious leaders, I don't think the brothers can see Joseph for who Joseph is, right? The religious leaders, when Yeshua came, they couldn't see the Messiah. But was it because they weren't looking for him? No, they were looking for him. I mean, they were looking for the Messiah, but they couldn't accept the Messiah because they couldn't hear his voice. They couldn't recognize who he was, and they couldn't hear the voice that he was speaking with. It's the same with the brothers here. They couldn't recognize what Joseph's role was. They couldn't accept what Joseph's role was. And so they come, right? They've conspired to kill him. Joseph shows up. Reuben's like, wait, don't kill him. Throw him in the pit. We have this story then of Joseph getting pulled out of the pit and being sold off into slavery. And many people at this point think, hey, Judah kind of takes the lead here. And he says, you know, maybe Judah was the one who killed this goat, who dipped the blood, the coat in the blood, and presented it to Jacob with these words, identify, if you please, is this indeed your son's coat? And, of course, this breaks Jacob's heart, and he is in mourning, and nobody is able to comfort him. And then it begins into the next chapter, into chapter 38, and it says, it was at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned away towards an Adullamite man whose name was Hurah. Possibly, not only did he go down physically, geographically to this place, but also he went down in esteem. Like, maybe the other nine brothers were like, holy cow, Dad's like super broke up about this. Wait, let's just tell him. Like, it wouldn't hurt to just tell him what's going on here. And Judah goes, no. Absolutely not. We're gonna keep this ruse going. He's gonna believe this, and if he goes to his grave in mourning, he goes to his grave in mourning. That's just what it's gonna be. Maybe Judah has a harder heart. I don't know. Some people think that. That's of course, we're reading that into the passage here. But so Judah now he comes back. He comes back to the father. He grieves him, and then he goes. Maybe loses esteem with his brothers, and he leaves again. He leaves his father's house. He goes down to Adullam to meet with this guy, Haran. They become maybe business partners. Judah takes a Canaanite wife, the daughter of Shua. He has some kids. The kids, at least two of the three kids, are wicked. They are struck down by Adonai. And he's got this daughter-in-law, Tamar, who's left. And now Judah is in the pits. I mean, just like, you know, he's basically killed his brother off or sold him into slavery. Similar, his two of his three kids have died. His wife has now died, and he goes up to shear his sheep. And surprise, on the way, he meets who he thinks is a prostitute, and she is not interested in money in the exchange, but is interested in things that are distinctly his. His signet, his wrap, his staff, or his strength, his power, and his authority. So he turns these things over in exchange for this, consorting with this prostitute, and he goes on his way. He sends a kid to get these things back, as we see in the text, and they can't find him, and he says, I don't want to be a laughing stock. Let's just let this go. And so we get towards the end of this chapter, and Judah finds out, oh my goodness, my daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant, and these people are saying, by harlotry, and he says, bring her out, let her be burned. And on her way out, she has this signet, this staff, and this wrap, and she sends them to Judah, and she says to Judah, identify if you please. Because by this man am I pregnant. She uses those same words that Judah had used years earlier with his father in the coat of his brother. And she says, are these yours? She doesn't humiliate him publicly. She doesn't seek vengeance on him. But she merely nudges him in the same way. Those same words. And at this point, Judah, I think, has an about face. A turnaround in his heart and says, wow, I have done wrong. The things that I have done have been brought before me, and I repent of them, and I want to do right. And I think that's the story. The two stories that are here, there's one Adonai gets his way. I mean, right? He had a plan, and he worked that plan. But he did it despite the brothers, right? The brothers weren't working with him, alongside him, to help him with this plan. They were doing their thing, and Adonai was like, okay, we'll do it this way. Okay, I'll use this and do that. But at this point in Judah's life, he changes and he turns and he says, I actually want to be a part of that plan. And that's the hope that I see in these chapters, is that that we can realize at any point that, hey, I've come off track a little bit here, or I'm going the wrong way here. I've left the Father's house in a way, or I've left the teaching that I know is true. But when that's made clear to me, I can turn around and say, I wanna actually work with Adonai on his plan. I know he's going to accomplish it. He doesn't have to have me to do it, but he invites me into it. He invites me to be a part of it. And I want to change. I want to be a part of that plan. I want to make a different or a better decision. So we can see that Adonai gets his way no matter what we do. But we can choose to go along with his plan and be used by him instead of being used in spite of him. So, okay, well, I'm going to invite Brandon to come up. Is that okay? Did you want to do it, Tim? No? Oh, great. I'm going to invite Brandon to come up and talk to you about chapters 38 and 39.
Shalom, everyone. Oh, it's up here. Nate's got a couple inches on me. Thanks, Tim. I still love Ohio. The 30 degrees isn't that bad. So I kept thinking about, what am I going to talk about when I finally get up here? Like, what am I going to do when it finally hit me? I'm going to talk about the Torah portion that I'm supposed to talk about. So I'm just going to read through, and we'll just go comment on a couple things. So we'll start in verse 2, and Genesis 39. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. He made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. It came about that from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned, and the house and all the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge and with him. There he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. So from verse 2 to verse 6, we see a serious change in authority. We see Potiphar actually delegating and giving his authority over to Joseph. So Potiphar put himself under Joseph's authority, under godly authority. And Potiphar gives all that he has to Joseph to care for. And, you know, I think for me this shows me that a lot of times we're blessed on the account of others that are godly, even if we don't deserve it ourselves. And Hebrews 6, 7 to 8 says, "For the ground drinks the rain which often falls on it, and brings forth vegetation useful to those for whose sake it is also tilled, receives a blessing from God. But if it yields thorns and thistles, it is worthless, near to a curse, in whose end it is for burning." So what it's saying there is that when Potiphar's house was under Potiphar, Potiphar isn't a godly man. And we all see that. And so it's going to yield thorns and thistles, but because Potiphar puts his house under Joseph, it bears good fruit. And there's one thing I really want to look at here, and that's that Potiphar did not concern himself with anything except with the food which he ate. So he's giving all of his authority to Joseph, but his food. And so Potiphar's kind of saying here that, Joseph, you take care of everything in my house, in my life, so that all I have to do, that I may be continuously blessed. But in regards to me and what I do, that is my responsibility, and stay away from who I am. You stay over there, and I'll decide what goes on in my body, what I do, what I watch, what I listen to, and what he feeds on. And so I kind of wanted to ask, do we do the same thing with God? And are we willing to change our habits and what we do and watch and see and listen to align ourselves with him? Or are we going to be like Potiphar and expect all the blessing and everything else, but when it comes to ourselves, our own souls, we're going to say, back up here. So now I want to go on to verse 7 with the temptation. And it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great evil and sin against God? As she spoke to Joseph, day after day, he did not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. And then obviously we see she grabs Joseph's garment, and he flees, and that's a wrap. And so when I was looking at this, it kind of came to my mind, you know, there's that Jewish prophecy that, you know, David would be, there'd be two messiahs, and one of them would be the descendant of David, and one would be the descendant of Joseph. And I figured, well, these are obviously two very godly men. And why did David fail but Joseph didn't? So I want to look at that. And so in Genesis verse 39, verse 10, she says, as she spoke to Joseph day after day, and he did not listen to her or lied beside her. And then I want to direct your attention to Second Samuel 11. Then it happened in the spring, when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab to his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. You know, David was looking to get into trouble, obviously. But Joseph even refused to hear. And so I think this is kind of telling us that our temptations often start with our senses. And you know, then we see that David's really playing with the idea of these temptations. He's going out and looking for them. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And David was probably thinking, I'll just find out what her name is. Maybe she isn't married, or, you know, he's just playing with the idea. He's stepping one inch closer to that line. One tiny, tiny step towards sin. It isn't sin, but he's getting there. And so I think the biggest issue that David is doing, he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, and David is idle. And when one is idle, we're often led astray. And so in Genesis 39, who do we see being idle? We see Potiphar's wife. In verse 7, 39:7, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. So here she is, watching Joseph day after day, and she's doing nothing herself. She's watching Joseph do all kinds of things, like cleaning, repairing the house, delivering things, delegating servants, landscaping, taking care of finances. Potiphar's wife probably didn't want to automatically lie with Joseph right off the bat. I mean, he's a Hebrew slave, really. I mean, what kind of, you know, head of the house, Potiphar's wife, would want to lie with a Hebrew slave? She just kept watching and watching and being idle and just, you know, giving into those thoughts that create the sin. And so she inched closer and closer to where she wasn't supposed to. And then it became to the point where she wanted to lie with him. You know, David's the same way. You know, I personally doubt that David saw Bathsheba in first drop. He was like, this is going to happen. I'm going to sin against God and it's going to be horrible. But that's what happened. And so David saw Bathsheba and he didn't think he was going to commit murder or adultery. But he took everything just one step farther in his mind and his thoughts, and inch for inch he did it. And so, I know Grant shared this before, but I actually thought it was pretty relevant just looking at this. It's a little passage from the Screwtape Letters, and it's about like an older demon to a younger, like, new tempter demon. And it says, you will say that these are very small sins. Doubtless, like all the young tempters, you are anxious to be able to report spectacular wickedness. But do remember, the only thing that matters is to the extent which you separate the man from the enemy. It does not matter how small the sins are provided, but that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light, out into the nothing, and away from the light and out into the nothing. Murder is no better than cards if cards can do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one. The gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts. So I think we really do need to be on guard constantly. Sin's desire is for us, and we should be like Joseph, who didn't even listen, didn't even give Potiphar's wife that inch. So, as I've come to Beth Tikkun and, you know, listened to a bunch of teachings and everything, and it's been great, and I've really started to really actually notice that the Torah really, everything else in the Bible really is a commentary on the Torah. And it's pretty amazing, it is. And so, 1 Peter, when I first started doing all this, 1 Peter 5:5 through 10 came to mind. And it says, you younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders and all of you. Clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Be sober in spirit, be on the alert, for your adversary, the devil, prowls like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. After you have suffered for a little while, the great God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Now, doesn't that sound exactly like Joseph? He subjected himself to authorities over him. His true humility, and we often see this by, you know, all the time, like, in my life, I'll catch myself complaining. And I feel like complaining, it's not being humble. And we don't see Joseph complaining once. I mean, this guy went through the ringer. His brothers threw him into a pit to die. And then he gets sold into slavery, gets sold into a house. He's actually doing very well, and he has a lot of authority. And then he gets thrown into prison. And this really, none of this is his fault. I think this is just to show that God really does bless Joseph. And I know that Peter had in mind when he wrote this, the story of Genesis. You know, Joseph didn't care about the circumstances he was in. I only looked towards God, and he trusted in him. You know, by no means what Joseph went through was easy. But he took up his cross daily and denied his pleasures and lived as a man of God. And he chose the hard path of denying himself and living for him. And that's what we should do. Everyone here like has that book of mysteries. And I really liked one of the quotes from it. Was that a pleasant way may lead to hell, and a hard way may lead to blessing and eternal life. Yeah. What Joseph didn't go through, it wasn't easy, but it led to blessing and eternal life. So I guess we're going to go to Genesis 40 now. And in Genesis 40, just to give a brief recap of the story. So Joseph is thrown into prison, meets the cupbearer and the baker. And both of them have dreams about serving Pharaoh, and Joseph interprets them being the mediator between man and God. And the cupbearer has a favorable interpretation, while the baker has an unfavorable interpretation. I want to ask why, because on the surface level, they both kind of seem even. I mean, when I first read it, I didn't see any issues with the cupbearer or with the baker. So the baker is a bad steward. And at first glance, it may not be obvious, but let's look at what the baker did wrong. He only had 1/3 of the baskets full of bread. A good servant would have all three. He's carrying the baskets on his head, completely exposed. And he's letting the birds eat the food that is for Pharaoh. So those three things are pretty serious. And, birds always represent evil. In Matthew 13, most of the chapter, we often see that the birds are devouring things that are good. So the birds are always a sign of the enemy. And so now that we actually know why the baker is evil, I want to look at just something I thought was really important here. That's what the cupbearer and the baker represent. And so Joseph's interpretations of them, of his dreams, was Genesis 40:13. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into your hand, according to your former custom, which you were his cupbearer. And then Genesis 40:19. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you and will hang you on the tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you. And so we see the baker, the flesh, is hung on the tree, just as Yeshua is hung on the cross. And the physical part that is Yeshua dies on the earth. And, obviously throughout Genesis and the story of Joseph, we see that Joseph is such a picture of Yeshua. And, through the cupbearer, we see that the wine, the blood presented to Pharaoh, just as Yeshua allows us to enter into his holy place through his blood. And we see that in Hebrews 19. His blood allows us to enter into God's presence. So we give the spiritual part to God, and we lay down the flesh and our own desires. So, we're called to be living sacrifices. And when a sacrifice is made, it's Leviticus 1:6, what is always taken off? The skin. The skin is always taken off, every time. It's not a sacrifice if the skin isn't taken off. And so, if we're called to be living sacrifices, what does that mean? That means that our flesh has to stay behind, and the new man has to live on the altar. We have to give up our fleshly pleasures, our desires, and we need to live on the altar for God and for his word. I had a verse of the living sacrifice up there of Romans 12:1. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and a holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship, and do not be conformed to this world. So I think that's a pretty good picture of a living sacrifice. And, I'm sure I didn't do this amazing picture of the cupbearer and the baker justice that it deserves, but it really is a picture of Yeshua and the bread is his body and the wine is his blood, and how the wine goes up to the Father, and the bread is the flesh, and that needs to be hung on the cross, hung on the tree, and we need to die to it. Are we taking questions or comments? Sure. Anyone? No. Okay. Shall we close in prayer? So, Father, I just want to pray that you would bless this congregation, and that you would make our will your will, like Joseph. And that you would give, and that I pray that something spoke to each one of our hearts today through what I said or what Nate said or anything. And that you would help us lay down our lives for you daily and take up our cross. And that we'll give you all the praise and the glory for it, Father. And I pray this in Yeshua's name. Amen.